Due to the hot and humid climate, they do not survive long. Thus, the very oldest existing manuscripts of the Mahabharata only go back to the 16th century. Many of the important versions are indeed much newer. Another important aspect of ancient Indian books is that they were written on loose sheets or leaves and then bound using string or metal hoops. This means that the manuscripts were very prone to having their binding broken, either intentionally to insert new pages, or by accident, resulting in the loss of pages and even possibly the scrambling of their order. Thus, for the Mahabharata to survive these thousands of years, it had to be constantly copied. The result is, like genetic mutations in a family tree, if you were to bring the various manuscripts together, you would find many differences, and also familial resemblances among groups of manuscripts, especially when grouped by certain regions and scripts. Some of the differences between the various manuscripts are quite important to our understanding of the characters and the story. Thus, when I have said, the book does not explain what authority Santanu had to grant this boon to Bhishma, I can't be completely sure that I'm right about this. There might be a version out there that spells this out perfectly, but then that explanation might be spurious. The same goes for the repetition and discrepancies. It is very unclear how these got into the story. Were they written in from the beginning, or did they creep in over time? To truly speak authoritatively about what is and is not in the Mahabharata, I would need to be familiar with many, many different versions of the story. Fortunately for us, much of this work has been done already. A massive project was completed in the last century that brought all of the ancient manuscripts together and compared them side by side. This team of scholars identified families of manuscripts, compared the points of differentiation, and then combined it to create a critical edition of the Mahabharata. A second project was then started at the University of Chicago in the 1960s to translate this official edition into English. It is this English translation by J.A.B. van Buitenen that I am mostly depending on for my research. Therefore, I can at least speak with authority about this critical edition of the Mahabharata, at least for now. The problem is, van Buitenen died in the 1980s, leaving his translation unfinished. Thus, I only have this as a resource up to about the first third of the book. After that, I'm on my own. Once I am set adrift without this translation, I will only have a much older translation to depend on, one which was based on only a single version from North India and translated by Kesari Mohan Ganguly during the Victorian era. For instance, some of you may be wondering why I never mentioned the backstory about Vyasa sitting with Ganesha as his scribe composing the Mahabharata. Well, the reason is, it isn't in the critical edition. I do promise that I will cross-reference the sticky points with Ganguly's edition just to be sure I'm not missing anything obvious. But I must confess that the language is difficult enough, and having to translate from Victorian English will be a challenge in itself. At least we're moving through the story much faster than the translators, so there's no danger of me dying of old age before I finish. Perhaps in future episodes, I'll review some of the other interpretations of the Mahabharata in Western, Indian, and Indonesian culture. But for now, let's get back to the story. We left off with the birth of the good guys, the five sons of Pandu called the Pandavas, and the bad guys, who were the 100 sons of blind King Dhritarashtra called the Kauravas. Before they were born, Pandu had resigned the kingship, leaving the crown to his older brother, who had originally been disqualified due to his blindness. To complicate things further, Dhritarashtra's wife conceived her son first, but was pregnant for 2 years, so Pandu's eldest son, Yudhishthira, was born first, even though he was conceived later. To make matters even worse, Pandu died while his five sons were very young, leaving them orphans in the care of their uncle, the king. Clearly, this was all a perfect recipe for disaster when it came to recognizing the legitimate heir to the throne. The eldest Pandava, Yudhishthira, was unanimously considered the heir to the throne, recognized even by his uncle, King Dhritarashtra. But the Pandavas were orphans, and King Dhritarashtra had every reason to be resentful over the original decision to bypass him for the throne and having to wait for his younger brother to give it up before he himself could become king. Clearly, it would take an incredibly upright and virtuous monarch to swallow his resentments, put aside the interests of his own children, and hand over the crown to a helpless orphan. It would remain to be seen whether Dhritarashtra was up for the challenge, but I bet you can guess. Following the funeral ceremonies for the dead Pandu, Vyasa visited with Satyavati and warned her that there could only be a bad outcome for this situation. Satyavati thought on this and then decided to leave for the forest as an ascetic. She took with her her two daughter-in-laws, Ambika and Ambalika. We only hear that they lived an austere life of renunciation until eventually passing on to the next world. As for the children, all the princes, Pandavas and Kauravas, lived together, studied together, and played together. Yudhishthira's second brother, Bhima, was already an incredibly strong child. Remember that Bhima was precisely the same age as his cousin, Duryodhana, and so he played with the 100 cousins as an equal. He was, however, vastly stronger than all the other boys, and he bullied them relentlessly. He would knock their heads together, grab 10 of them at once and hold them under water until they nearly drowned, and drag them by the feet through the dust. We are reminded that Bhima did these things not out of malice, but because he was just being a kid. Duryodhana, however, was not without malice, and he greatly resented Bhima's superiority at sports and his bullying at play. He began to scheme up ways he could disable Bhima, thinking that if he could only get Bhima out of the way, that he could easily overpower the remaining Pandava brothers. Duryodhana tried various methods of disabling Bhima. For instance, he tied him up and threw him into the river to drown. But Bhima was able to easily break his bonds and walk out. Duryodhana then set cobras on Bhima, and he was bitten repeatedly in his sleep. But he was so tough that the serpent's teeth could not pierce his skin. Bhima then killed all the cobras with his fists. Finally, Duryodhana, with the advice of his uncle Shakuni, who was Gandhari's brother, got hold of some poison and poisoned Bhima's food. Again, Bhima was so robust that the poison did not affect him. The Pandavas were aware of these attempts against them by their cousin, and so was their uncle Vidur. But none of them felt secure enough to make an open confrontation with Duryodhana, his father the king, and Duryodhana's uncle Shakuni, who was the king of Gandhara. And so, the orphan Pandavas simply tolerated these attacks. The attempt at poisoning could not be considered just a childish antic. It had taken a good deal of organization and had the feel of an international conspiracy. Thus, the king decided that it was time these boys were placed under the discipline of a guru. Two gurus were in fact found for these boys, both of whom were Brahmins, and both had oddly similar origins. The first teacher, named Kripa or Kripacharya, had been found as an orphan in the forest by Santanu. Later, he was to discover that his father was a powerful Brahmin named Gautam. Gautam had pursued the art of weapons to such an extent that the gods were made nervous. They sent down an apsara to seduce him and sap his strength. And so, the nymph appeared before Gautam emerging from her bath. The warrior was stunned by her beauty, dropped his weapons, but remained perfectly still. The only effect her beauty had on him was to cause a spasm, and his sperm fell on the ground. His potency was so great that the drops of sperm germinated into two children, a boy and a girl, without the intervention of a mother. The boy was Kripa, and he was trained in all the military arts by his father. Kripa was to teach both the Pandavas and the Kauravas to master the art of archery. The second guru was actually discovered by the boys themselves while out playing. They were playing some sort of ball game when the ball fell into a well. The boys all looked down and could not figure out a way to get the ball out. At just that moment, Drona was passing by. He laughed at the boys' inability to solve the problem and made a demonstration for them. He put some of the magical power of his bow into some reeds, and then threw one of the reeds into the well at the ball. The reed hit the ball squarely and pierced it. Drona then threw down a second reed, which struck right into the end of the first one. He then threw down a third reed, which attached itself to the second, and was able to pull the ball out of the well. The boys were amazed at his ability, and they informed Bhishma of this Brahmin's talent. Bhishma then questioned Drona, who gave him his backstory. Dronacharya is sometimes difficult to distinguish from Kripa because both are Brahmins that are skilled at weapons, both are considered gurus to the princes, and they both were born only of a father. In Drona's case, his father was named Bharadvaja. He too was a master of the Vedas and of weapons, and he too was tempted by an apsara. It seems the gods are not comfortable with Brahmins that are warriors. In the case of Bharadvaja, as he watches apsara alight from heaven, her skirt was blown away, and Bharadvaja's seed fell into a trough. It was in this trough that Drona was conceived without a mother. Drona was put under the care of a guru who taught him the art of war. He had a fellow student named Drupada, who was the crown prince of the kingdom of Panchala. As children, they were close friends, and Drupada would dream of the time he was king, and told Drona that when he became king, Drona should come to him, and they would enjoy the riches of the kingdom together as friends. Drona took this promise seriously, and later, when Drupada ascended the throne, Drona went to Panchala to congratulate him and expected a generous welcome. When he arrived, however, Drupada scorned him, saying Drona was a nobody and not his equal, and thus could not possibly be considered his friend. Badly stung by the king of Panchala's scorn, Drona departed for Hastinapur. Recognizing Drona's talent with weaponry and warcraft, Bhishma placed him in charge of the young prince's training. Drona badly wanted revenge for Drupada's rejection, so he asked his students to promise him that they would help him in seeking his revenge. The Kaurava princes were reticent, but Arjun, not even knowing what he was committing himself to, readily promised to help his teacher. This was the beginning of Arjuna's close relationship with his teacher. This story about Drona's feud with the king of Panchala and his occupation as the crew's teacher could be interpreted in a different way. It is interesting that the kingdom of Panchala was the Kuru's direct neighbor downstream of the Ganges. When we look back at the genealogies, we hear that Panchala once defeated the Bharata dynasty and drove them off their lands. Remember, it was King Kuru who recovered the kingdom for the Bharata dynasty from the Panchala king. In addition, we don't see any attempts at creating alliances by marriage between the Kurus and the Panchalas. Finally, when we look at Pandu's list of conquests east of Hastinapur, Panchala is definitely not on the list. So, Panchala is neither an ally nor a client, but they are a close neighbor. I think it gives us reason to believe that Panchala was a serious rival to the Kurus in international politics. Therefore, when a skilled warrior, Drona, with a grudge against the king of Panchala, showed up at their doorstep, the Kurus were quick to offer him hospitality. Drona may be a useful surrogate in any future attack on Panchala. This indeed happens later in the story. The story of the prince's training under Dronacharya is made up of a few short vignettes. The first of these involved Arjun, who was without question the teacher's pet. Drona gave orders that Arjun not be allowed to eat in the dark. Then, one evening, while eating, Arjun's candle blew out. Arjun suddenly realized that even though he could not see his hand nor his mouth, he could still find the food and bring it to his mouth. He had an epiphany. He went out in the dark and began target practice. He realized that just as your hand can find your mouth in the dark, the same principle could be applied to any target. Thus, Arjuna was able to hit any target, even in the dark or with his eyes closed. Drona was delighted with Arjun's proficiency and told him he would surely be the world's greatest archer. The second vignette involved a son of the chief of the Nishadas. The Nishada boy, named Eklavya, came to Drona to study archery. The Nishadas must have been a sort of barbarian tribe because Drona refused to train the boy. Eklavya withdrew into the forest and there made a clay statue that had the likeness of Drona. This he worshipped as his guru and spent all his time practicing at archery. His devotion to his guru was so great that he actually became a magnificent archer. Later, the Kuru princes went out hunting, and the retainers brought a dog along. The dog drifted off and encountered Eklavya in the forest, practicing with his bow. Smelling the dirty Nishada, caked in mud and stinking, the dog started barking and barking at him. Eklavya responded with a fistful of arrows, which all flew into the dog's mouth and plugged it up. The dog went running back to the Pandavas, who were thoroughly impressed. They went looking for the archer who did this, and came across Eklavya the Nishada. Eklavya told them that he too was Drona's pupil. The Pandavas recalled how Drona had turned the boy down, and so they went to their teacher and reported what they saw. Arjun went to Drona when they were alone and reminded him, "Remember when you said that I would be the best archer? How is it that you have another pupil, that Nishada, who excels me and everyone in archery?" Drona thought on this, and then took Arjun to find Eklavya in the forest. When they came across the boy, he was dressed in tatters and caked in mud and ceaselessly practicing with his bow. When Eklavya saw Drona, he immediately stopped, touched Drona's feet, and paid him due respects as a teacher. Drona said to him, "If I am your teacher, then you owe me my fee. Eclavius said, What can I offer you? Just command me and I shall pay it. Drona answered, Then my fee is your right thumb. Without hesitation, the boy took out a knife and cut off his thumb and offered it to his guru. Now, the Asian method for notching an arrow is to hold the bowstring with your thumb. So, without a thumb, the boy could only use his fingers, and this drastically slowed his ability to fire arrows quickly. After that, Arjun, that little kiss-up, was happy, content that no one would be a better archer than he. Out of all the Kuru princes, the five Pandavas were the best at weapons. Yudhishthira was the master of the chariot, Bhima was the greatest with the club or mace, and the twins Nakula and Sahadev were skilled at swordplay. The best of the Pandavas by far was Arjun, who excelled at all weapons. This left the Kaurava princes, led by Duryodhana, to stew in their jealousy. When all their studies were completed, Drona assembled the boys to test their skills. He had an artificial bird made and attached it to the top of a high tree where it was barely visible. He then called on Yudhishthira, who was the eldest, and asked him to notch an arrow and aim at the bird. He asked Yudhishthira what he saw. Yudhishthira replied that he saw the target on the tree, as well as his teacher and his brothers. Drona said, Then be off. He then called on Duryodhana and asked him the same question. Duryodhana answered in the same way and was also dismissed. Drona then tested each of the boys in turn until lastly he got to Arjun. Arjun notched his arrow on the bow and took aim. Drona asked him, Now, what do you see, boy? Arjun said, I see the target. Drona asked, Do you see the bird, the tree? Do you see me? Arjun said, I see the bird, but I don't see the tree, nor you. Drona then asked, If you see the bird, then describe it. Arjun replied, I see its head, but not the body. Drona was delighted, saying, Now shoot. Without hesitation, Arjun fired and pierced the bird in the eye, making it fall to the ground. At that, Drona felt confident that he would get his revenge. A few days later, while bathing in the Ganges, a crocodile swam up and grabbed Drona by the leg. Even though Drona was perfectly capable of saving himself, he called on his students to rescue him. While the other boys were still figuring out what was happening, Arjun had already fired a salvo of arrows into the crocodile, forcing the wounded beast to let go of Drona and sink under the waves. Drona was extremely proud of his top student. He presented to Arjun a weapon called the Brahma Head and instructed him on how to use it, saying that it could only be used against supernatural enemies because if used on normal humans, it would destroy the world. That ends Book 7 of the Mahabharata, called The Origins. The Kuru princes are ready for graduation day, and Duryodhana is as jealous as ever. Drona has big plans for revenge against his former friend Drupada, the king of Panchala. In the next episode, we'll start into Book 8, called The Fire in the Lacquer House. We'll discover that there aren't just five Pandavas after all. There's a mysterious sixth brother who will make his appearance for the first time. Thanks for listening. This is the Mahabharata Podcast, Episode 9, Burning Down the House. We left off in the last episode with the Pandavas and Kauravas ready for graduation day. Their teacher, Drona, had been discovered by the boys as he had just left the neighboring kingdom of Panchala with a chip on his shoulder. The king of Panchala, named Drupada, had been Drona's classmate and had promised him a life of luxury when he finally became king. After Drupada became king, however, he shunned Drona as a mere commoner. Drona was shamed and angered by this and left for the Kuru court to plot his revenge. We also heard a lot about the childhood of the two middle Pandavas, Bhima and Arjun, and how their cousin, Duryodhana, resented their superiority and tried several times to put them out of commission. Bhima and Arjun were by no means perfect. Bhima was unnaturally strong and thoughtlessly beat and bullied his cousins. Arjun was a skilled warrior, but also a prissy little teacher's pet, who was willing to go to underhanded means of ensuring he was always the top student. but their cousin Duryodhana made them seem like angels in comparison. He schemed with his uncle Shakuni to find ways to put the Pandavas out of the way so he could be made crown prince. We heard little of the eldest Pandava, Yudhishthira, probably because he was really a good kid. He wasn't the greatest warrior or the strongest of the bunch, but he was the son of Dharma, and he held his brothers back from taking any revenge against Duryodhana's scheming. We have met a lot of characters so far, and we'll meet many more, who all have some important role in the story. I'm doing my best to leave out any superfluous characters, but I should mention that Drona had a son named Ashvatthama, who was about the same age as the Kuru princes, and was also trained by Drona at the same time. There's a legend that when he was born, he whinnied like a horse. I don't know if that is foreshadowing some of the bad things he'll do much later in the story, but you might as well be aware that Drona had a son who stayed loyal to his father through thick and thin. More on him later. After having tested his students and determining that they were now fully trained, he informed the king, Dhritarashtra, that it was time to have a display of arms. The blind king then ordered a large stadium to be constructed where the boys could make a demonstration of their skills. The stadium was duly constructed and sanctified, and a great event was held in which folks from the entire kingdom attended. The event began with a display of archery, on foot, on horseback, on chariots, and from the backs of elephants. Then duels were held, using various weapons. The fights were purely for demonstration, so there was no conclusive outcome, but most people admired the Pandava's skills, while others favored Duryodhana and his brothers. At one point, Bhima squared off with his cousin Duryodhana, each wielding a mace. The crowd divided and took sides of each boy. The two engaged for a few rounds until a riot nearly broke out, and Drona had to step in, sending his son to stop the contest. Finally, Drona presented his star pupil, Arjun. As Arjun stepped out into the stadium, fully armed, the crowd went wild. Dhritarashtra asked his brother Vidur to describe what was going on. Vidur told him that it was Arjun in all his glory. Dhritarashtra exclaimed how fortunate he was to have such great warriors as his nephews, the Pandavas, supporting the kingdom. Arjun then set about displaying his skills. He demonstrated his magical abilities to create rain, fire, and wind. He was able to disappear and reappear in different places, and then showed his ability at archery, shooting 20 arrows into a hollow cow's horn hanging from a string. Near the end of this demonstration, as the day was winding down, there came a crash at the gate, and in came another warrior, a stranger, named Karna. This mighty warrior entered the grounds, bowed, none too respectfully, to Drona and Kripa, and then yelled out, "Arjun, whatever feat you have done, I shall do it better, right here, before the eyes of all these people." Karna then displayed his skills at archery, doing many of the same tricks that Arjun had just performed. The crowd again went wild, and Arjun burned with anger. Duryodhana, meanwhile, was delighted at this surprise entrance of a warrior who could challenge Arjun. He welcomed Karna and offered him hospitality and friendship. Arjuna was thoroughly annoyed and called out to Karna, "There are special hells for uninvited guests, and you shall soon be there after I send you to the other world." Karna's response was equally churlish. "Talking is for wimps. Let's settle this with our weapons, and I'll take your head off right here before your teacher's eyes." Thus, the two heroes squared off, the crowd took sides, and even the heavens divided up. Indra caused an immense storm cloud to build up over Arjuna's head, while Surya, the sun god, burned away all the clouds and shone brightly over Karna. As for Arjuna's mother, Kunti, witnessing the fight about to happen, she fainted with dread. Just as the contest was about to begin, Kripa stood in and said, "According to the rules of the contest, before a fight may begin, each warrior must state the names of their fathers and mothers and your lineages." At this, Karna's face fell and burned with shame. He seemed to back down over the prospect of revealing his birth. Duryodhana, however, did not want to let Arjun off the hook so easily. So he stepped in and announced, "There's more than one way to become a prince. One is either born a prince, becomes a champion, or leads an army. If Arjun will not fight a man who is not his equal, then I shall dub him king of the Angas." Duryodhana called upon the priests, who right then and there anointed Karna king of Anga. Karna was blown away by this turn of events, and in gratitude to Duryodhana, asked him, "What can I possibly give in return for your kingship?" Duryodhana replied, "I only seek your friendship, nothing more." Karna shouted, "So be it," and they embraced. Having seen his son so rapidly promoted to the title of king, Karna's father emerged from the crowd. He was a simple charioteer called Asuta. He congratulated his son for his amazing achievement. When Bhima saw this, he laughed. Karna's the son of Asuta. You have no right to fight and die by the hand of Arjun. You have no right to enjoy the kingdom of Anga. No more than a dog has the right to eat the holy offerings. Karna boiled with anger, but Duryodhana responded. Bhima, you have no right to speak this way. Might is the father of Kshatriyas. Like the origins of rivers, the origin of kings are all obscure. Our teacher was born in a trough. How could a doe give birth to a tiger? By this time, the day was over. The pageant had been completely derailed by the entry of this strange warrior. The final contest between Karna and Arjuna would have to wait for another day. If you're wondering who this guy Karna is, who is able to cause such a disturbance, here's his backstory. Way back in episode 7, when I described Pandu's marriage to the princess Kunti, I explained that before she had gotten married, Kunti had been given a magic spell from a great sage. She was told that this spell could summon any god and would give her a son by him. Well, when she got it, she decided to test it out, just a little bit. So she called on the sun god, and it worked. He appeared before her. Of course, there were two parts to the spell, and so Surya, the sun god, wanted to get it on. Young Kunti, terrified, tried to get out of it, telling Surya that she was just testing. She was a maiden, and it would be the death of her if she got pregnant. Surya told her it was too late. What was done, but he would do her the favor of leaving her a virgin, and she would give birth on the same day so she could avoid getting in trouble. So Kunti gave birth to a glowing, powerful baby boy who was literally born with his armor and earrings on. There was nothing to be done about it, so Kunti had to abandon the child before she got caught. She placed the child in a basket and set him adrift down the river. The baby was eventually found by the wife of a charioteer of the Suta Jati. This child grew up to be Karna, who disrupted the great weapons demonstration of the Kuru princes. So that explains why Kunti fainted when she saw Arjun and Karna preparing to fight to the death. They were both her sons, so no matter what the outcome, it could only end in tragedy for her. Thus, the rivalry between Arjun and Karna is really a conflict between brothers, one of whom is the son of Indra, and the other the son of Surya, the sun god. Another question you might ask is, how did Duryodhana have a kingdom at his disposal to give away just like that? I can't answer that one. He just did it, and no one disputed it. So now Karna is king of Anga, but also a low-born son of a charioteer, and also the secret son of the queen mother. You might also notice that Drona was not too happy about this guy. First, Karna broke up Drona's big festival, and secondly, Karna challenged Drona's star pupil. Drona was a pretty touchy guy about things like this, see King Drupada, so you can imagine that he'll have a grudge against Karna going forward. Following this event, his students having graduated into the status of warrior, Drona set out to get his revenge. He asked all the Kuru princes to attack the king of Panchala and take him prisoner. Duryodhana, his brothers, and his new friend Karna all clamored to be in the vanguard. Their plan was to invade the capital city and take its king prisoner. Arjuna advised his brother Yudhishthira that they should hang back, so the Kauravas led the attack on Panchala. Duryodhana and Karna entered the city gates in a surprise attack and began fighting their way down the city streets to get to the palace. The palace guard responded and used the local buildings as cover while they fired down on the attackers. This halted the Kaurava attack, and then the townspeople joined in, and they all started showering the Kauravas with bricks and stones, forcing them to retreat out of the city. As they retreated, the Panchala king mounted a counteroffensive and pursued the Kauravas back towards Hastinapur. Meanwhile, the Pandava brothers stood in reserve, and as the Kauravas retreated, Arjun and his brothers mounted a renewed assault on King Drupada. This was Arjuna's moment to shine. He fired arrows in such quick succession that the whole motion was just a blur. Since he did not want the king dead, only captured, he used his arrows to destroy the king's bow or cut his bowstrings. The king must have had a lot of spare bows, because this happened repeatedly. Finally, Arjun leapt from his chariot, drew his sword, and physically grappled King Drupada, making him his prisoner. This ended the war with Panchala. Arjun brought his noble prisoner to his guru and presented him. Drona said to Drupada, Now that I have taken your kingdom and despoiled your capital, would you like to revive our friendship? Well, never fear, I will not take your life. In fact, I'm a Brahmin, and Brahmins are always forgiving. I'll even do you a favor. I'll give you half the kingdom of Panchala. I will retain the other half, so I too will be a king. Thus, we will be equals in our friendship. I only desire that you be my friend. King Drupada, not in any position to argue, expressed his gratitude for having half of his kingdom back. Thus, the northern half of Panchala, bordering the Kuru lands, was made a separate kingdom with Drona as its ruler, while Drupada retained only the second half of his former lands. Having made this arrangement, Drupada was released. He went back to his lands and set out to find a way to get his revenge. In particular, he needed a son. Following this and other exploits, King Dhritarashtra had it decided that Yudhishthira was the legitimate heir to the throne. Then Bhima and Arjuna set out on a campaign against their eastern neighbors and subjugated many kingdoms, including ones that Pandu had not been able to conquer, and returned with piles of loot. The people of Hastinapur began to mutter, saying, "How is it that Dhritarashtra had been passed over because he was blind, but now he's king anyway? Here we have this capable son of Pandu. Why isn't he made the king right now?" Dhritarashtra was aware of this chatter, and it made him very distrustful of his nephews. He worried that they might mount a palace coup. At the same time, Dhritarashtra's own son, Duryodhana, was boiling with jealousy. He complained to his father that there were movements afoot to have them deposed. He pointed out that there was no use in making himself third in line to the throne, because obviously, once Yudhishthira became king, the title would pass on to his son, and all of Dhritarashtra's sons would forever be left out of the succession. He suggested that they should drive the Pandavas out of the kingdom and use their absence to solidify their own political base. King Dhritarashtra protested, saying that the Pandavas were not without their own supporters, and if it came to a civil war, the Pandavas might very well emerge the victors. Duryodhana took this conundrum up with his advisors, specifically his maternal uncle Shakuni, his friend Karna, and his brother Dushasana. Shakuni was very astute politically and utterly unscrupulous. Shakuni pointed out that the Pandavas were really without any allies in the royal clan. Bhishma was sworn to uphold the throne and was thus forced to be neutral about these issues, impotent as it were. As for the guru Drona, his beloved son Ashvatthama was a strong ally of the Kauravas, and Drona would always side with his son. Vidur was a bastard and dependent on his elder brother for his livelihood, and Kripa would go along with the rest. Thus, there wasn't much to fear after all. Duryodhana then proposed to his father that they just send the Pandavas away to another town, and while they lived far from the capital, the king and his son would secure popular support for themselves. What Duryodhana did not tell his father was that he was working on a plan to assassinate the young princes at this remote township. And so King Dhritarashtra summoned his nephews and explained to them that in the town of Varanavata there was a festival coming up in honor of Shiva. He asked them to attend this festival as representatives of the crown, and while there, to enjoy themselves in this lovely hamlet. Yudhishthira had a pretty good idea that they were just trying to get him out of the way, but a good son obeys his elders and treats even a suggestion as a command. So he asked for their blessings and prepared to depart, along with his brothers, for the city of Varanavata. As the Pandavas made preparations to depart, Duryodhana summoned his chief architect, named Purachan. Duryodhana told him that he had all of the king's wealth under his command, but only so long as the Pandavas were out of the way. He then instructed the architect to build a palace for the Pandavas in the town of Varanavata that would be made entirely of extremely flammable materials, paper, cloth, bamboo, oils, and resins. Having thus accommodated the Pandavas in a death trap, they would set fire to the building. The Pandavas would be assassinated, but the townsfolk and barons would all think it had been an accidental house fire. We must imagine that at this point the Pandavas were still just boys, because their mother was sent to accompany them on this journey. We are told that each brother was born a year apart, so we might imagine the Pandavas at this time ranging from 16 to 11 years of age, orphans and otherwise helpless under the protection of a jealous uncle. They were also virtuous and obedient, and so they set out for the town of Varanavata in a somber mood. The citizens of Hastinapur smelled a rat and started to congregate around the departing princes, offering to go with them, But Yudhishthira reminded them that the king was like their father, and whatever the king commanded should be obeyed without question. Finally, their good uncle Vidur approached them. He had managed to divine Duryodhana's plans and wanted to warn the boys of their danger. Worried about being overheard, he framed his words in a philosophical riddle using a barbarian tongue, telling them, "There are weapons worse than swords. This weapon can wipe out a forest in just a few moments, but the wise creatures are the moles and porcupines who can go under the earth and survive." Yudhishthira understood his uncle's meaning, and thus warned, they departed for Varanavata. The boys arrived to a warm welcome and were placed in regular lodgings while the architect Purachana completed the lacquer house. Upon its completion, Purachan escorted the Pandavas and their mother to the new dwelling. As they toured the palace, Yudhishthira was able to quickly ascertain that the building was indeed a death trap. In private, he described his observations to his brothers. Bhima asked, "Shouldn't we just go back to our old quarters? Why don't we just leave?" Yudhishthira replied that this would be a bad idea. At this point, Duryodhana had them surrounded by his spies. They had no idea whom they could trust. Their best option would be to stay put, but prepare to save themselves from the fire. That same day, a sapper arrived from Hastinapur. He introduced himself to the Pandavas and told them Vidur had sent him, and he was at their service. The sapper informed them that Vidur had discovered more information. It turned out that the night of the fatal fire had been scheduled for the evening of the next new moon in about 14 more days. Yudhishthira set the sapper to work secretly, digging a tunnel so they might escape in the event of a fire. At the same time, the brothers pretended to go on hunting trips by day, but were in fact reconnoitering escape routes. Once the tunnel was completed, and their plans for escape all worked out, the boys decided it was time to make a move. That evening, following a banquet which they hosted at their flammable house, Yudhishthira ordered the house to be ignited. It turned out that liquor had been served with the meal, and the corrupt architect Purachan had gotten drunk and passed out in the house. Unbeknownst to the Pandavas, a Nishada woman and her 5 adolescent sons had also partaken of wine at the feast and had fallen asleep inside the house. Bhima, always enthusiastic about exacting revenge, snuck into the room where Purachana was sleeping and started the fire there. He then set fire to the doors, and then the 5 brothers took their mother and made their escape through the tunnel they had dug. As the house burst into flames, the citizens all gathered around it and cursed Duryodhana, saying, "He surely is the cause of the death of these fine princes." As they combed the ashes in the morning, they found the bodies of a woman and 5 young men. Word quickly spread of the death of the Pandavas. King Dhritarashtra was grief-stricken and ordered funeral rites to begin. Meanwhile, the boys continued their escape through the jungle all night and into the next day. Their aging mother quickly grew fatigued, and so Bhima picked her up and placed her on his shoulder and thus carried her through the woods. The family traveled deeper into the wilderness, on and on, until they were all nearly fainting with fatigue. Yudhishthira knew the danger was not yet past and they must keep moving, so he asked Bhima to mount all of his brothers onto his shoulders and carry them all through the woods. Bhima carried them all like an elephant, pushing trees out of the way, wading across rivers, and smashing through the underbrush. Finally, Kunti could bear the travel no further and asked to be set down. She then asked for a drink of water. Bhima set them down to sleep in a tree, and then set out to fetch some water. Not having any means of carrying water, he simply soaked his upper garment in a river and brought that back to his family. When Bhima got back to his mother and brothers, he saw them lying exhausted on the ground. Bhima thought to himself, "How did we get to this point? How is it possible that this great queen is lying on the cold ground without a blanket? If only Yudhishthira gave me the word, his wicked cousins would not live another day." Bhima worked himself up to such anger that he couldn't sleep, so he sat up through the night watching for predators. Living in a tall tree not far away, there was a demon, or Rakshasa, named Hidimba. Rakshasas are monstrous, ogre-like creatures. This one in particular was black-skinned, had red hair and a red beard, blazing red eyes, and pointed ears. Rakshasas also loved the taste of human flesh. Hidimba had a sister named Hidimbi. He smelled the Pandavas nearby and instructed his sister to sneak up on them and kill them all so they could feast on them. The Rakshasa Hidimbi snuck up on the Pandavas as they slept and saw Bhima sitting awake. As soon as she set eyes on him, she was instantly smitten. She thought to herself that she would certainly make him her husband. She asked herself, how could I obey my cruel brother? A woman must place her loyalty to her husband above that of her brother. If I spare him, I could enjoy him forever and ever. Thus infatuated, she transformed herself into a beautiful woman and approached Bhima. She asked him, what are you doing out here in the forest? Don't you know that there is a wicked Rakshasa living nearby? You're in great danger. She admitted that it was her brother who wanted to eat them, but she offered to take him away directly and they could frolic in the mountains. Bhima refused to depart without his family, so she offered to protect them from her brother. Bhima declared, I fear no Rakshasa, nor Gandharvas, nor Yakshas. I'm not going to wake up my family just because of an ogre. Step aside. I'll take care of this. While the ogress and Bhima were having this discussion, the Rakshasa Hidimba grew impatient. He burst in on them and saw his sister's appearance and quickly figured out that she was in love with this human. In his rage, he made to attack his sister, calling her a harlot. Bhima scolded the ogre, saying, Cool your temper, Rakshasa. I'll fight you, but don't wake up my family. Saying that, he grabbed the ogre by the leg and dragged him away from the camp. Then the fighting began in earnest. The fight was something like two rabid elephants fighting to the death. Trees were felled and the ground shook. The commotion woke the Pandavas and they saw the ogre's sister sitting with them. Arjun approached the fight and called out to Bhima, saying, Bhima, you woke us up with all your commotion. It looks like you need our help. Either finish this guy off right now or I'll have to come to your assistance. At these words, Bhima made a final effort and smashed the Rakshasa to the ground, causing him to scream out in pain. Then Bhima grabbed its head in one hand and its feet in the other and bent the body backwards until it snapped in half, earning him the congratulations of his brothers. Bhima then turned to the beautiful ogress as if to kill her as well. Yudhishthira had to stop him, saying, You have already overpowered her brother, so what kind of threat could she pose to us? There's no point in killing her. Hidimbi then declared to them all her love for Bhima and appealed to Yudhishthira to allow her to marry him. Yudhishthira consented, permitting Bhima to go off with her each day so long as she brought him back to his brothers by nightfall. Bhima, having agreed to this arrangement, left with Hidimbi to frolic in the woods and mountains. Not long after, the Rakshasa woman conceived a child and gave birth to him the same day. This is how it works with Rakshasas. The child grew quickly. In just a few days, he was fully grown. The child had an abnormally large, bald head, and so he was named Ghatotkacha, which means water pot head. The boy was immensely strong and powerful with the magic of the Rakshasas, as well as intensely loyal to his father and uncles. He promised them that he would come at any time if they needed him. He then departed with his mother for the mountains. Following this episode, the Pandavas traveled incognito across the lands of India, visiting the holy sites in the guise of ascetics, studying the Vedas and philosophy. They eventually came across their grandfather, Vyasa, who was delighted with the decision the boys had made to live in the forest. He promised them that their exile would not be forever, and that their experiences living off the land would one day help them greatly. Vyasa comforted their mother Kunti, promising her that her sons would one day win back their birthright, and she would see justice done for them all. Vyasa predicted that one day Yudhishthira would be emperor over vast territories, but for now they should move to a village called Ekachakra and stay there anonymously. Vyasa introduced the princes to a Brahmin living in this town, and told them to stay there quietly until he returned. That's all for now. We'll leave our young princes living in obscurity like Brahmins, praying and begging their food. Their uncle and cousins believe the Pandavas are all dead and out of the way. Only their good uncle Vidur secretly knew of their survival. Duryodhana, meanwhile, happily took up his post of crown prince, spending the treasure won by his cousins to build alliances and support among the barons of Hastinapur. Next time, we'll see the Pandavas come out of hiding in a big way, winning alliances with neighboring kingdoms, and more importantly, a single wife for all five husbands. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the Great Bharat. That was episode 8 and 9 of the Mahabharata podcast from Lawrence Manzo, available on iTunes, and check out his website at mahabharatapodcast.blogspot.ca. So two fairly lengthy episodes there. First one about 20 minutes, second one about 26 minutes, and a fair bit covered. My first comment is the episode 8 starts off with some comments about the story itself, the book, the written words, and its journey through time, and how it may have changed. And this is a story that reached, as was said, Southeast Asia, India, and probably a little bit to the west as well. So this, the story, being as fantastic as it is, spread quite a bit geographically in that region. Now, it may be that there was an oral tradition before the story was written down, and was actually a precise oral tradition, because I am aware that there is, at least with the Vedas, there's an oral tradition of recitation. And essentially these Brahmins, their sole purpose in life, one of them is to recite these ancient works, and they're actually written in the form of verses, say of a song. So it just may be that before the epic was written down, it did manage to survive a long period of time, essentially unaltered. But this is a little bit of kind of educated speculation, let's say. Of course, after it was written down, and then it had to be copied from age to age to keep it alive, to keep it from disintegrating, as was said, in the heat of India. So we get introduced to the early lives of the cousins, from when they're boys growing up. Two gurus were assigned to them. Both of these gurus were Brahmins, i.e. holy men. The first one was Kripa, and the second one was named Drona. And what's interesting is that they both kind of have the exact same backstory. Their fathers were both great Brahmins who were feared by the gods. They were powerful to such an extent that they were feared by the gods. And then the gods sent down apsaras to seduce them. And these apsaras are essentially goddesses. And both of them, they didn't even touch the apsaras, but they ended up producing children. So we're looking at children produced without mothers in the medium of, in the case of Kripa, it was water. And in the case of Drona, it was also water in a trough. So I find that parallel kind of interesting. Another interesting character that pops up is Akavlya. And he's from a group of people who are, I guess, considered barbarians. And he, I guess, has heard of Drona's might. He's an admirer of Drona, and he comes along to try to become Drona's pupil. Drona being a master of arms, archery, etc. Unfortunately, because of Akavlya's background, he is not qualified to even be trained by Drona. So Drona essentially just sends him away. And Akavlya goes into the forest. Not put off by this, he creates a false idol of Drona. And what's interesting is he actually becomes a master archer simply by pure devotion to this idol that he created. He did not have the benefit of having a live Drona in front of him to teach him techniques from Drona's experience. However, he did still become a master archer. He still did achieve greatness in archery just by simply focusing his mind on this idol. And I find that concept rather interesting in the context of the general Western opposition to the worship of idols. Without any kind of evaluation of if it may be a useful thing, or I mean, why in the first place do we have this this great opposition to the worship of idols? It's just interesting, interesting tidbit in the story, what this kind of thing can produce. Obviously not as real as the real, having the real teacher there, but hey, he got somewhere. In the end, however, he's discovered by everyone, by Drona, etc., and he's made to cut off his own thumb, which he does without question. So even in that cruelty, he's fully devoted to his teacher. I believe he comes back later in the story, and so we'll get to him and see where he ends up. The final test of the cousins that Drona sets up, I'll refer to it as the bird test. So when he puts the bird up in the tree, and then he asks each of the cousins to fire at the bird, and then he asks them questions about what they see. If you go and watch the Peter Brooks film, which is available on iTunes, just search Mahabharata Peter Brooks. This scene is very well done in that film, I think. You really get the essence of what's being said here, which is essentially that what Drona is looking for is absolute focus on the target. And when you achieve that absolute focus, then you're able to be the most powerful at whatever you're doing, I guess. We also get introduced to the character of Karna. Karna is the son of the sun god, or Surya. Surya is the sun god. And also Karna is Kunti's son. So Karna is a character who probably one of the most important characters in the story. And in the Peter Brooks film, it could be said that the story itself is about Karna. So pay attention to him. He's very, very important in the rest of the story. And you can already tell the complexities starting to build between his relationship to his mother. He doesn't know who his mother is. His half-brothers, who are the heroes, and his kind of half-cousins, I guess, who are kind of his newfound friends. However, they're the bad guys. So Karna, very important character, and you'll see later on in the story how important it gets. Now, the Pandavas at this stage in the story are between 11 and 16, so they're teenagers. However, it's already apparent that Yudhishthira is their leader now, and the rest of the boys follow him very obediently. They treat him as their leader, and he takes lead. So when they're asked to go off to another town and they kind of smell trouble. The boys follow his direction without question, even though they don't want to do it. They do it anyways. We kind of get a little glimpse here of Vidor's divine sight, Vidor being their uncle. His divine kind of abilities come up later on in the story as well. And the final thing is the story of Hedimbi, who is a Rakshasa, Rakshasas are kind of demon creatures of the forest. And she falls in love with Bhima. And we get some pretty good stories here about Bhima and Bhima's incredible strength and his general invincible nature, carrying all his entire family through the forest. He can deal with any physical situation that arises. It's kind of neat. And I don't know if everyone out there is familiar, but this is a free plug for Bhima's Warung in Waterloo. It's a fine dining restaurant in Waterloo, South Asian French fusion at University and King. It's just right next door to Morty's, just south of Morty's, say between Morty's and Burrito Boys. Check it out. But the name of the restaurant is based on Bhima. It's called Bhima's Warung. Let's check it out. Very good food there. So that is part 3 of The Great Bharat. And next week we'll be going on to episode 10 and probably 11. So please tune in again next week. It's every Sunday, 11:30 to 12:30, right after Sargam Radio. And just wanted to remind everyone, in case you were not aware, something on an unrelated note, there is an interesting event happening today, and that is there's a comet that is coming into our solar system, and it's going to be flying very close to Mars. The distance between the comet and Mars on closest approach is going to be about the one third of the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So if you think about how close the Moon is and how well you can see the Moon, think of it being two thirds closer, and that's what it would be like to be on Mars and watching this comet. The fact that NASA has all of these, two rovers on Mars and several satellites surrounding Mars studying various things, they've maneuvered all of their instruments in a position where they can watch this event unfold now and into the coming weeks. So it's going to be an interesting month ahead of us. But today at 2:40 p.m., our time is when the closest encounter will occur. So jump on Twitter, jump on the web to get some updates. You won't see any kind of visual live feed per se. What you'll probably end up seeing is kind of blotchy, spotty images of various telescopes and things like that. There are some ground-based observations, but it should be an interesting day and month ahead. So check it out. So we'll see you all again next week. Please tune in again right after Sargam Radio every Sunday, 11:30 to 12:30, The Great Bharat. And hope you enjoyed this week. I'll get the podcast posted up on soundfm.ca pretty soon. So have a good Sunday. Thanks for listening.